We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast. Soylent Green is people. I'm your host, Kurt North, and without further ado, I'm going to introduce straight away the longtime guest on the show, Darren Mooney. Darren, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
That's an interesting, loaded question. I've been editing your voice for the past 5 hours, so how do you think I am?
I'm very sorry, Kurt. And I love that you were like, how do I follow up editing Darren's voice for 5 hours? I'll get him on to talk for about 5 hours. Listeners, I assure you, this podcast may run about an hour and 10 minutes. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff we have to cut to get that sort of pure nugget of gold.
There is, yes. And as always, it's the first time. It's one good thing about having to edit. Out of all of the hassles that you have to do with editing in any general form is that I get to hear the episode before everyone else, which is fantastic. So so I know what's coming, so it's all good. And it would have aired by the time people hear this, so it's all good. So we are here to discuss Season 1, Episode 22, which is Paper Dove. It was written by Wallen Green and Ted Mann. It was directed by Thomas J. Wright. It aired on the 16th of May, 1997. Now, with me editing your podcast yesterday, I know that you know what this score got.
Yes.
So there's no point doing that game. But I am going to play a little game with you in a second with regards to IMDb. So, the score that it received was 8.2. Now, do you think that's a fair assessment? And what would you give this episode, and what's your general first thoughts before we get into the episode in more detail?
This would be, I'd probably give it an 8 myself. Again, I'm very fond of there only being 20 points on my 10-point scale, you know, or 21 yeah. points if you can't see your own 10. So, you know, I think 8.2 is a fairly solid sort of grade. Now, there are, you know, if you're comparing it to the average IMDb score, is it? I think it came out a joint third episode of the season, tied with, was it either the pilot or with Lamentation? I don't have the IMDb in front of me, but one of those two it was tied with. And I'm not entirely sure I'd agree with that. I'd probably bump it down. It'd probably be my fifth favorite episode of the season, roughly. You know, because I think that obviously I put Lamentation, Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions. And as you're well aware, Kurt, I suspect, yep. having yapped on about it for so long, I'd obviously put the damn it, Force Majeure and the Thin White Line up there as well.
You're right. The pilot was joint with this one, joint third. So we had Lamentation, which was down as the top, and we had Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions as second. So then you had the pilot and then this episode. Now, what do you think came joint fifth?
Damn it.
There's two episodes that come together.
Okay, so, and are they related to one another? So I'm guessing The Judge is one of them.
Nope.
Damn it. Okay, so let's do higher or lower. First half of the season, second half of the season.
They're both in the second half of the season.
Oh, okay, cool. So first one up is, I'm going to say Covenant.
That is one of them, yes.
Okay, cool. And so, okay, so let's do process elimination. This is going to make great radio. I know it's not Broken Word. I know it's not Maranthana, because I love Maranthana, but I think that's less well accepted than people by people. I know it's not Thin White Line, so I'm going
to... Do you not think it's Thin White Line, Darren?
I feel like you're leading me in a... You're corralling me, Kurt. So fine, I'm going to say Thin White Line.
It was Thin White
Line. Yes! IMDb, I take back everything I said about you having terrible taste.
Yeah, so Thin White Line. So I'm surprised that Force Majeure, to be fair, wasn't in there.
I think it's a bit weird. I think it is a very odd movie, a very odd episode, even by the standards of, again, you know, Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions, or Lamentation. I think that Force Majeure is odd even beyond that, to an extent.
So that gives you an indication, anyway. So as we were saying, what's your general thoughts on this particular episode before we delve into the episode in more depth?
I like it a lot. I think that, you know, I would give it an 8 out of 10, as I said. That generally indicates that I'm very, very fond of it. There's a lot in this episode that I love, and we'll talk about that stuff in a bit more depth. It does have a number of problems that hold it back from being my absolute favourite episode of the season, and kind of hold it back from the episodes that I think are truly exceptional, like Force Majeure, like Thin White Line, and like the Lamentations and Powers sort of duology later in the season, even like the pilot, perhaps. So I think that it has these problems that hold it back, and they're structural. And they're very clear, like, we're going to be talking about them, I suspect, when we hit one particular part of the episode. And the issue is that this is a season finale, and it works rather well as a season finale in one sense for me. And that sense, very vaguely, without getting too particular, is the sense in which it kind of wraps up this chapter in the life of Millennium. I know that people are listening to the podcast for the first time going through this, so I'm not going to be too particular in terms of spoilers, but I think we've alluded to in earlier conversations that Millennium, to a certain extent, can be argued to be three different shows in each of its three seasons. And so the season finales, to a certain extent, are series finales in that they draw the shutters down on a particular vision of what Millennium could be. And I think that, you know, again, I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say that, you know, the second season finale is one of my favorite, you know, 2 hour blocks of television ever made. I don't think this is that good, but I think this is very good at kind of taking a look at everything that happened in the first season. We'll talk in a bit more depth about why I think that is, but I think that it closes a particular version of what Millennium is in a very elegant way, in a very rational way, and in a way that is very emotive and feels like a good grace note on which to say goodbye to that particular version of the show. So that's why I think it's an excellent kind of season finale, particularly in the context of Millennium. The bit that holds it back, ironically enough, is the bit where it feels like a season finale in a general television sense, where it feels like we've reached the end of the season and we have to have a hook in order to catch viewers who are going into next season. And I'm not going to be too specific about it, but it does end on a cliffhanger, and that cliffhanger, and again, you can argue about how well it's been seeded, whether in previous episodes or in this episode in question, it feels very much like it's kind of stuck in there without any relation to what the meat of the episode is about. And that's kind of the issue for me that holds it back from kind of getting a 9 or a 10, if we're being honest.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we want to bring up with the Polaroid Stalker when we get into that and more depth later on about how that's linked in with this episode, because it is an interesting take on how the episode runs, because without that element you could just have this as any normal mid-season episode in some ways.
But a very
good one at the end, and I think they've definitely you've mentioned about the things that they've done during the course of the season. We can get into a little bit of that now, things like that fact that he enters the home at the very beginning of the cold open, and there's the obviously the serial killer aspect of it. There's things like that that are kind of sort of the epitome of what season one it has been, apart from obvious things like Force Majeure, like we spoke about, or even Thin White Line to a degree. You know, those episodes aside, there is serial killer episodes in there. I mean, it even latches on a little bit to things like 522666 with Catherine and how she's dealt with in this episode. So there is a lot of things that have kind of been stewed up in the pot, and this is effectively what the final outcome is. I don't know if you would agree with that.
I would agree with that, but I would, and this is the thing where it gets, this is why it gets the 8 rather than losing the 2, if that makes sense, is it is very much that. It is entirely and absolutely that. It is a serial killer of the week episode through and through. It is very much of a piece with episodes. Like, I mean, even going back, if you strip the supernatural elements out of The Judge, to pick an example, you mentioned 522666, for example, but even things like, you know, Ted Mann's other script, Loin Like a Hunting Flame, which is a great title in a terrible episode, but that sort of routine of stuff. But what it gets at the 8 is that it takes everything that it's done. You're right, you mentioned it being a stew, but in terms of us being a stew, it realizes it has had at this stage, you know, 21 odd episodes to figure out what flavors work and what flavors complement each other and what ones it wants to bring out and what ingredients it wants to add to that basic thing. And I think it does something that the first season of Millennium has struggled to do. And I'm just going to lay it out here in broad terms, and we'll maybe get into it when we discuss the episode in question. One of the things that myself, and I particularly like when I've talked with Chris Knowles about Millennium, but also when I talk to you about it as well, we've talked about is that Millennium is a very grim, very serious, very dark kind of television series. And it doesn't have a lot of hope. It doesn't have a lot of warmth in it. You know, and it's very depressing and grueling. And I've talked about it on the, you know, I've talked on this podcast before about how when I watched the first season to review it, watching it night after night, it would give me nightmares, and not out of any one particular episode. And I don't consider myself easy to scare, but just because it's attrition. You know, you're watching so much of it, and it's so dark, and it seeps in. And you know, to a certain extent, that's to the show's credit, but it also makes it very tough to watch. What this episode does, and what I think makes it a fitting, I talked about drawing down the shutters on a particular version of Millennium. What makes it so effective at doing that is that it understands that you can have all of that, and it can be just as effective of all of that. And, you know, we're going to talk about the serial killer of this particular week later on in the episode, so I don't want to be too specific, but he is just as grueling and uncomfortable and monstrous and grotesque as any other serial killer in this season. But accepting that you have that fear and that darkness and that horror, it adds the missing ingredient, something that's been sorely lacking from a lot of the season, not all of the season, but a lot of the season, which is this idea of empathy and this idea of compassion and this idea of understanding. And it's something that the episode has to be very delicate about, and something that, you know, I'm going to be very delicate when I talk about it, but understanding that there's a humanity at the heart of all of this, in a way that the show sometimes doesn't always capture with its serial killers. There's a tendency to treat them as like grotesque monsters. I mean, think about Wide Open, think about Weeds, think about any of the episodes where these things are, those serial killers are likened to the aliens of the X-Files. They're monsters. They're monsters of the week, basically. And again, not going to talk too much about Dion here, but in the context of Paper Dove, He is absolutely a monster. What he does is monstrous, horrific, and the episode never shies away from that. He's a creature of nightmares. But he's also very much a human being.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely sorely missing from a lot of the first season of Millennium, and it feels like adding that element now, and on top of that, adding other elements within the episode that emphasize that humanity, that emotion, that warmth, that compassion, that empathy, kind of underscores a bit of what was missing. It's too much to describe as hopeful. I mean, I think when I talked to Chris Knowles about Powers earlier in the season, we talked about how, like, Millennium's idea of hope is that if there is a God, he's beyond our understanding. And, you know, maybe getting up and going out into that dark world and knowing that we're not going to actually do anything worthwhile, but going out and doing it anyway has value. That's Millennium's idea of a hopeful, optimistic beat. But with Paper Dove, there is a sense of compassion where it's like, actually, everybody is a person, even these people who seem absolutely monstrous and alien grotesque. And so there is something that binds us all together in the world. And that's, you know, I don't want to say hopeful, because that's not at all hopeful. It's a really dark episode of television. But by the standards of the first season of Millennium, this is practically, you know, sort of like a triumphant orchestra rising, sort of like closing montage with the sun shining on your face kind of episode by the standards of Millennium.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. As I say, without us going into too much detail on it, I'm sure that we are going to delve into that, because the serial killer here is a lot more well-rounded than other ones, and that's not to say some of them weren't, but they seem to have just cottoned on to exactly how to portray this person, and we'll get into that in a bit more detail towards the main show once we get into there. Just for me, just on my rating, I would agree with you. I think I was hovering around an 8, and as it happens, I've watched it twice again in preparation for this podcast, and there is things that you wouldn't necessarily notice, and I've noticed a few things with regards to doing this podcast and seeing Millennium as a full piece. Now, I've mentioned this before in the past, and I know that loads of people have, and I think, believe you have as well. This is not a binge-worthy TV show. It's really grim. It's really horrible, and it takes time to get into the show. But if you can watch it week by week, you can get through it. And this is a different nature in which TV's run now, and it would be run completely differently. I mean, we've got Mindhunter, as we record, we've got Mindhunter coming out on Friday.
I suspect we're going to be talking about that later on, particularly in the context of one important guest star here.
Exactly. So we've got this. It's not really binge-worthy TV as such, and it is a hard slog to do. But doing this podcast has made me realise in some of the thoughts and processes that people have gone through and explained how they viewed the episodes and how they view Catherine, how they view Frank, and how they view the episodes, is that is all, as we were saying, in a stew now. And rewatching this now, I've got a new new viewpoint on it and a new kind of perspective, which I wouldn't have had in previous viewings of it. Even as long ago as 6 months ago when I did the last rewatch that I did, which was only, you know, I only did it for like, you know, literally a year ago, but 6 months I finished it. So yeah, so that I do have a new affinity, a new perspective on this episode. And it hasn't changed my opinion on it by any means, but it has given me more of a viewpoint that I wouldn't have had this podcast not been around. So this has been a fantastic way to go. So I think without further ado, we need to go into the main crux of the episode, which is Paper Dove. Okay, so in the cold open, we get to see the first on-screen victim. She's out shopping in Hagerstown, Maryland. She is followed home by a stalker, and which we'll later come to know as Henry, who's driving a beat-up Ford van. And he's playing a song called Stranger in the House by Wayne Kramer, apparently. How do I know this? Because 30 minutes ago, I went and used a well-known listening app and put that against my computer just to find out what that song was. So I've got no idea other than that what that song actually is.
But we do see him. Relevant. It's almost as if there's going to be a stranger in a house.
Correct. And also they it also links
foreshadowing. In. Foreshadowing.
Exactly. And we've had plenty of strangers in the house over the course of the season as well. Yeah. So, yes, very apt. But we do see Henry come out to the this middle-class kind of housing area, something that we've seen in Millennium before. And you do actually see through the window that his top half is half naked. So that would gives you some ominous signs about what's going to happen. But the main point of this cold open is that he does take a Polaroid, which we've seen throughout the whole of season one. What did you think to the cold open in general and the way that the Polaroids are used in this particular instance before we get to see the Polaroid stalker?
One of the interesting things about this episode, again, it's something that only really twigged on me rewatching it this time around, and it's kind of embarrassing, is how much emphasis the episode places on the idea of Polaroids. He says, smacking his head against his forehead, his hand against his forehead, as if, you know, this isn't an episode featuring a character credited as the Polaroid Stalker. But I mean, even outside of, we're going to talk about the Polaroid Stalker later on, I imagine, but just thematically, one of the interesting things about Polaroids and about the use of Polaroids, particularly the use of videotape here, is the question of, and again, this is empathy as it comes back to, and the question and the divide that exists between empathy and voyeurism. And it's something that kind of watching this time around, I was wondering, is the show doing something maybe vaguely metaphorical? Because again, later on, not to jump too far ahead, you have Catherine's sister who's recording her on videotape in order to capture a little bit of sort of family joy and a little bit of happiness and a little bit of fun. And I remember when I watched this, you know, the first couple of times I watched the episode, particularly watching the second half, to me, that seemed like it was set up for, you know, what would happen in the next episode. Yeah. Where I imagined that they were going to have a videotape and they go back and they play the videotape and it will provide a vital clue in order to, you know, help solve the case. I'm not going to say whether or not that happens in the context of the next episode because that's a spoiler. But it does get at something in this episode with the idea of Dion taking a photograph, even though he's not the Polaroid's, you know, stalker we find out later in the episode. Because it's about watching, it's about observing, and it's this idea of whether you treat the object that you're watching. And again, this is something where I wonder, how self-aware is this, right? Because, I mean, there's a whole host of, like, conspiracy stuff we're going to talk about. We talk about the Polaroid Stalker, mythology, X-Files, all this sort of stuff. But in a broader thematic sense, when you're staring at a picture of someone, the question of whether or not you see them as a fully formed three-dimensional human being, or you see them as purely, you know, an object within a frame. And I wonder if, and again, this is probably reading far too much into it, and it is worth noting, by the way, that the screenwriter on this is Ted Mann, who also wrote earlier episodes like Going Like a Hunting Flame, but also I think The Judge and also Paris with Valley Sounds Dominion. But he has a co-credit with Waylon Green, who is an Oscar-nominated screenwriter who wrote The Wild Bunch. So, you know, it's a bunch of writers who know what they're doing, basically. And I wonder if this emphasis on looking and Polaroids and video and capturing images of people is hinting at maybe a little bit about the idea of the show itself. Because obviously we're all looking at pictures and we're all watching. And one of the big tensions, and it is something that exists in movies and stories about serial killers in general. I don't think it's specific to Millennium. But it's this question of exploitation and this question of like why we are watching, why you I and all the listeners are sitting down and have decided, you know, on our Monday evening or Friday evening or, you know, Sunday evening, whenever, have decided to watch a show about watching people get brutally murdered, and sort of what we're hoping to get from that. And I wonder if tying to this episode's particular, like, heavy emphasis on the idea of compassion and empathy is something that's important. And how, you know, and I don't want to write off the rest of the season, because I think that even episodes like The Thin White Line is very much invested in the idea of compassion, empathy, and emotional connection as it exists, and moral responsibility and stuff like that. So I'm not writing that off at all.
Yeah. Well, I would say Wild in the Incident as well is another perfect example of that.
Yes, it is as well. And obviously drawing on stuff like Badlands as well directly. And you know, the case as well. The Starkweather case, I think, as well. But the issue with this is that there's the question of kind of like, are we seeing, is there something in reducing a person to a two-dimensional image? Is that like something that we should be thinking about as a society, you know, that is uncomfortable? You know, it's obviously not directly comparable to, you know, serial killing or cutting women's throats or, you know, bringing them out to a campsite and burying them in under leaves and having conversations with them. But is this something that we do as a culture? And I wonder if there's something there in that with the Polaroid snap. Sorry, this was a very long ramble when you just asked about the Polaroid picture, but it's something that kind of really struck me this time.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting viewpoint to take, because the Polaroids do come up a few times during the course of the show. I mean, we know that our good friend Mike Atkins, you know, God rest his soul.
Threat assessment, Mike Atkins. I still love the idea that you pitched of the show where he would just every week wander into a different, ridiculously dangerous situation.
Oh, absolutely. That's definitely going to become a spin-off at some point. I think that, you know, they've got the David train over in the next cast. I think we've got to come up with a Mike Atkins equivalent, because, you know, we need it. But yeah, so there's an episode with...
Oh, we called the Atkins diet. The Atkins diet?
Yes. I see. You know, I was wondering where the pun was going to come in this week, and I was never in a million years thought it would come from Mike Atkins. So, yeah, you've got me on that one. Well done.
No worries, I dovetailed that one nicely.
Okay, so you've got... I'm trying to be serious now, Darren. I'm trying to be serious, okay? Sorry. There's Polaroids being taken. You know, this is... We're now in the almost 2020s, and we're talking about Polaroids. So you're talking about that. It also comes up in Lamentation as well, as a use of the fear factor. And then, you know, we're then finding out that what we would assume is the Polaroid stalker is going to be this character we don't know the name of yet, but we later becomes Henry. So yeah, so it is an interesting one. But yeah, but looking at it from your viewpoint about, you know, are we bringing it down to a two-dimensional character, because he's not defined, especially with what he's wearing as well, the fact the glasses and the slick back hair, and we never see a full image of him. He's always like in the shadows and not really nearly being formed as a character. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting point that you put across there. Also as well, you know, you were talking about the video element to it. Now, I know we don't want to go too much into the second episode, and we won't touch upon that.
Yeah.
But there's no secret in the fact that, you know, seasons 1 to 2 and then 2 to 3 do change, and that Morgan won't take over. So what they were planning at the end of season 1 isn't what happened at the beginning of season 2. So we know that much. So there is elements that has been placed in. So you were saying about the potential for this video. To be maybe used again, and now we won't say if it has been used or not, but there is that video element. Now we do hear a car, which is his car. I don't know if you noticed, picked up on that. Also that, well, they're actually in the garden. You do hear that his car driving past, or a car that sounds very much like his car. So I thought that was quite interesting. And then something we'll get into a little bit later on, but the Catherine gets a hang up towards the end of the season as well, and I don't think that gets picked up. So there's elements that are obviously being littered in just as maybe a writing development choice that come in. That have been placed there, probably to fill holes that we can get into in the second episode. When we do come out of the credit scene, we're introduced to Catherine's family. And in this episode, the family is a big part to play in both Henry's story, the story with Malcolm and his dad, and also Henry and what he's going through with his mother. What was your opinion, first of all, on Catherine's family, especially with her dad and sister?
What's interesting is that, and I think we talked about this in the podcast before, whether we're talking about the pilot episode or even talking about like Lamentation, one of the interesting things about the first season of Millennium is you can see Carter, and again, I know this, he's not credited on this episode, but he's very much his show running at this stage as well. And, you know, he's making big creative decisions behind the scenes. You can see him playing with ideas and images and sort of iconography that he's going to recycle later on for the X-Files. And in particular, it's notable that, and again, not to get too spoilery about the, how this, you know, concludes, but the fact that it is taken over by two different writers with a very different vision of the show, it's notable that, like, the way in which Catherine's family is set up here, which is this sort of, like, conceptually suspicious of Frank, you know, they're sort of wary of him. His sister, her sister in particular, is asking, you know, well, I just want to see you happy. And, you know, Catherine is talking about how she is happy and how she's, you know, she does have friends, she says, even though we've never seen any of them outside of Frank, and even though her sister doesn't seem to believe it, and she eventually settles on, I have Frank. What you see is, what's interesting is in the next season premiere of The X-Files, the fifth season premiere, Redux 1 and Redux 2, you see Mulder having a conversation with Scully's family, which feels like it's kind of almost thematically carried over from this episode, where it's like, Scully's family take Mulder to account for drawing Scully into his world and the consequences of that. That's kind of an interesting sort of baton pass. And in particular, there are elements of this episode and the way that Catherine goes home and then is kind of almost immediately abandoned by Frank because he has to work on this case, which remind me a lot, again, of the fifth season of The X-Files with episodes like Emily and Christmas Carol, where Scully, you know, goes off to be with her family while Mulder's doing his own thing, you know, and you have a call and a hang up there that happens and a misconnect and sort of Scully going off and trying to assess where she is with her own life. And kind of in terms of Catherine's family, you see, I think there's a sense of Carter like throwing balls up into the air and thinking these are good ideas and not entirely sure where he's going to apply them or how he's going to apply them. And maybe, without getting too specific, if they don't apply to the second season of Millennium, and to be honest, without getting too specific, you could argue that they bypass the second season entirely, yeah. And the confrontation that is you think is coming after this episode actually arrives in the third season premiere, which is kind of a wonderful one, you know, one season late delivery on that sort of confrontation. But it does feel like sort of, you know, Carter's playing with these ideas and not sure where they're going. It is interesting, though, when you mentioned the idea of family and home, how, again, we talked on the podcast before about how much of the violence in Millennium happens within the context of the family home. How much of, like, you know, and again, this is literal in the case of episodes like Wide Open, where a character comes into a home which is open and then sort of, like, waits until after dark and murders people in it. Or Weeds, where it's a gated community which has walled itself off from the world, but the killer is secretly in there all along. But even things like the Well-Worn Lock, which is, you know, about abuse and incest and assault within the context of a family home as well, and this perversion going on there. And you have this mirroring throughout the episode as well of this idea of dysfunctional families and families that are dysfunctional to varying degrees, and the question of whether or not the people who are in these dysfunctional relationships fully understand them. So again, we're not going to talk too much about, you know, Dion now at the moment, but, you know, his relationship with his mother, where it's implied that, you know, if he is aware of how dysfunctional it is, and that's a big if in a very literal sense, in that it is obviously dysfunctional, and there's a question whether or not he's sublimating it or whether he's consciously aware of kind of how he feels about it. I think the episode sort of skirts the limits on those. But there's also things like the relationship that exists within the household that Frank visits later on, which has been sort of torn apart by trauma and has this schism between, you know, the father who has one opinion of his son, the mother who has a different opinion, and the idea that they both have different opinions that they've never reconciled with one another, and the implication that they haven't even really talked about it amongst themselves. So despite living within a family household, these people are so alien from one another that, you know, they haven't had these simple conversations. And even things like within the family household that Frank goes to, which is the purest and happiest of family households in the episode. But even then, there's a sense of Frank being apart from it all, and a sense of Frank being sort of alienated, and the fact that, like, simmering beneath the surface, there's all this stuff happening. There's the, you know, again, the sister saying, let's not talk about Frank's trips over dinner. And, you know, Catherine pointing out later on that that's a really barbed and mean thing for her sister to have said about her husband over the course of what should have been a nice family dinner. So it's kind of interesting how all of that kind of plays through here, where the home is a scene of violence. As you pointed out at the start of the episode with a stranger in the home, the home is a scene of violence in terms of like stranger danger, in terms of like stranger killings, in terms of somebody from outside the house coming in and committing violence. But you also have this idea that plays out of the home, even as something that exists, being a place of violence fundamentally and unsettlingly, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And that was one of the things that I was just coming up to, actually, with the fact that they've got the B plot pretty much is Frank looking into the murder of the woman. And like you said, that that family is schism because of the event that's taken place, that Malcolm is in the prison. You've got the mother and the father, that the father's totally disowned him, and you've got the mother who's really wanting to believe that he didn't do it, and there's that schism between the three of them. This also links in with the actual main plot as well. It kind of comes full circle, and it links in with what Frank's actually investigating. Will actually come back and links in with Henry. Now, how did you think that worked from a plot driven point of view, that it was believable enough to get round to that, or do you think it was a bit forced? How do you feel that went?
Yeah, this is one of the things where, and again, I talked a little bit about this with Chris on when we talked about Powers, about like one of the things about the second half of the first season of Millennium, and it's something that I really like about it, and we're going to talk about it when we get to Climax a bit more, I suspect, as well, is that the show becomes less about the how of serial killer hunting and pathology and sort of forensic psychiatry, and a lot more about like existential questions like why, or sort of theme as opposed to plot, if that makes sense. Because if you think about like the logistics of this episode, they don't really make a great deal of sense, right? Again, we're going to talk about the Polaroid Stalker, I suspect, in more depth in a moment. But like, he's talking to Dion about how he wanted Dion to have abducted the woman while Frank was in the state and in the area, so he would get drawn into the investigation, and so he'd kind of end up sort of like getting, you know, kind of ensnared in this trap that the Polaroid Stalker had presumably laid for him. However, the plot contrives to have Frank, through, you know, this familial relationship, you know, the couple who happened to be at his wedding, who happened to know Catherine's father, and therefore he gets a request to look at this case, coming at it, you know, kind of circuitously, kind of circling back around to it, in a way that does feel very contrived and very convenient. It's like, it turns out this was actually the same case all along. And it's like, I understand that, you know, the law of kind of, you know, conservation of narrative means that most of the details in your story have to make sense or tie back into a single overarching idea. But it doesn't necessarily make a great deal of sense in terms of like a logical ABC linear plotting. Mm. I don't mind it too much, but I think that's a fair observation to make of it.
Yeah, it's not as far out as Force Majeure, so we're okay. at least it makes sense.
You say that like it's a bad thing. It not being as far out as Force Majeure is like a negative on this episode. If it turned out that I don't know, Hunzinger was secretly like an alien angel hybrid who had like foreseen the, you know, end of the world in the woods, where it just happened that Dion was camping out, I'd be like, yeah, this is a 5-star episode. This is like 10 out of 10.
I'm being very facetious. So we do get Malcolm's story. The only thing I'm going to mention during the prison scene, and we are going to talk about Polaroid Stalker next, but Malcolm's story is delivered to Frank in the prison. He wants to hear his side of it, and the snide remark of asking if he's profiled him, I just think that's another incredible small moment that just goes to show how good Lance Henriksen is. Because the way that he portrays that particular section really gets him back. Well, apart from actually gets him into the story, because he seems invested, because he looks like he believes it without saying anything. And I think that's really good on screen, that you're not being told that he believes it. You actually see it in his face. And just the way he reacts to him when he's saying, are you profiling me? Which seems like a weird thing to do when this guy is trying to help you. But that's one of those things. But that's kind of where I was with that. Have you got anything to say about Malcolm and his portrayal or where he was? So
it ties back into that idea of empathy and compassion as well. The idea that, you know, again, you have Frank sitting on the other side of a literal screen because he's interviewing him in a prison. And you have this idea of him being an image or an idea, and Frank trying to see him as a person. I mean, there's the wonderful conversation even with his father, where Frank is saying, you know, I've known men that have committed violent crimes that feel remorse. And Sior's response to that is, so what? Who cares what these animals feel? Do you? Mm. And there's this idea that, like, Frank, and again, this is something that's been suggested throughout the season. I mean, you've obviously seen it in Covenant, to pick an example as well, which is another episode that is very sympathetic to its, you know, perpetrator to a certain extent, or to the person who is accused of being the perpetrator and the person who feels themselves responsible for what happened. But even here, you have this idea of Frank going to visit this guy in a prison and kind of like allowing himself to see him as a person. And that allows him to kind of come to understand that he's not the killer as well. But it also ties into what the episode's doing with kind of, you know, with Dion, where Dion is sort of a bit more well-rounded and a bit more developed and a bit more allowed to be a human being than a lot of the serial killers in the show have been to this point. So I think it kind of, it does all fit with this idea of empathy and compassion as things that are important to what Frank does. And I mean, you know, again, Frank's ability is to put himself in the mind of a killer in the style of Will Graham. Empathy is obviously very, very important. I mean, it was Hannibal, which is a show that owes a great deal of, you know, a great debt to Millennium, makes it very explicit that Will's power is empathy driven. It's his ability to understand other people, even when those people are alien or monstrous or grotesque. And sort of like the idea of the boundary pushing that exists between Hannibal and Will in that context. And Millennium, you know, we talked a lot on this podcast about like the flashes of light that, you know, the flashes that Frank sees and whether they're supernatural or whether they're psychological or whether they're intuitive or whether it's subjective or whether they're being sent by some other force. The show hasn't always, and I think it has in particular episodes like Covenant and like The Thin White Line, it has occasionally sold the idea of those being rooted in empathy and the idea of seeing these monsters as people rather than as monsters. But it's only really here, and it's through that really clever step of giving you a falsely convicted, you know, sort of would-be killer, a man accused of killing his wife. And it's notable that, like, the description that he offers of the scene is quite striking, because he talks about how, you know, he'd come in and he'd guess what was cooking for dinner. And he'd say, it smelt like roast beef, and he comes in and he finds the body of his wife. Which sounds like a really grim and dark sort of joke. Ah, what are you cooking? Oh, it's just a dead body there. But it's somehow so uncanny and so weird and so uncomfortable that it could be, you know, kind of like a psychological, something a serial killer would say, where it's like, you know, well, my wife was dead, but I was curious what was happening with dinner. But it also becomes simultaneously something very human, which is like, I was processing this thing in front of me that I had no idea how to make sense of. And it's weird that the detail that I remember that my brain has latched on to is the fact that it smelt like she was cooking roast beef. And it kind of, like, the episode bridges that divide really well between this is grotesque and monstrous and inhuman, and this is also paradoxically the most human thing. And kind of, I like the seeding that kind of with the plot involving the kind of, you know, the failed conviction kind of allows you a gateway into that.
And I think it's telling that, and I only just noticed it wasn't me looking for it, that the first vision that Frank gets is 25 minutes into the episode. It's well after all of this has happened as well. So I think that was probably done quite on purpose, really. But it was just something that I'd noticed as I was watching it for the second time when I was just making my notes before coming on. So we do need to speak about the Polaroid Stalker. I think we need to put this into context of season one, because we are at the end of season one. So I think I'll get your general overview of the Polaroid Stalker over the course of the season. But he appears in the car with Henry looking over to him. Henry kind of mentions a bit of Shakespeare about the angels, not the angels, the fairies. And he also says about the fact, as you mentioned before, about that the blacks are in town and it's all been timed to sort of link in with that. And he seems very much in this is the first real insight that we get in him, that he seems, in season one's version of him anyway, a very controlling figure. What did you think of the Polaroid Stalker overall, both in the entire run and the thematics? You mentioned the 2D pictures anyway, but on that, but also the actual Stalker himself up until the end of this episode?
Yeah, because he becomes a very different he becomes quite literally a different person in the next episode, not to offer any spoilers, but X-Files fans will probably be quite happy to meet the Polaroid Stalker when he sort of, he literally peels off his facade in the next episode. But with regards to here and with regards to the first season, the Polaroid Stalker is an interesting character, in large part because he's so undefined. He's a nebulous external threat for most of the season. And in fact, actually, he's more of, again, this is the thing where Millennium, I talked about this, I think, again, I've talked about this in a couple of the earlier podcasts kind of that we've had, where Millennium's mythology is mostly thematic rather than literal, in a sense that maybe they could have tied it together if there'd been a consistent showrunner working for 3 years who had an overarching plan and idea where everything was going. But because of the way the series ended up being structured, it ends up kind of, it's more about recurring motifs and images. So like the Polaroids, like, again, it's notable that Lucy Butler sends the Polaroids, I think, in Lamentation, for example, to the Black Household. So they're not necessarily specifically linked to this one individual, at least not specifically in the context of the first season. They're more just a general sense of paranoia and uncertainty, an idea that you are being watched and surveilled and that something is lurking in the darkness staring out at you, even though you can't see it. What's interesting in the context of Paper Dove, because Paper Dove is the time that we most, you know, we have the most, you know, we get the clearest look at who this person is, like in terms of narrative function. And it's interesting, I think, because the episode seems to suggest, wary of giving spoilers for future episodes and future seasons, but it's an idea that Millennium does come back to when Chris Carter gets a bit more involved in the running of the show later on in the third season. But it seems like the Polaroid Stalker is involved in directing and manipulating serial killers. In particular, there's this weird sense of him almost like shopping out victims to killers and encouraging them and sort of feeding them, and not in like a kind of an allegorical sort of way. It's not like he doesn't appear to be a demon in the same way that Alistair Pepper was in Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions. He seems more like a kind of a conspirator in The X-Files, like the cigarette smoking man, if the cigarette smoking man dressed entirely in black wore sunglasses and had a questionable goatee in terms of the late 90s. But it's interesting because I'm not entirely sure that this conception of the Polaroid Stalker works for me personally, and I think it's maybe a flaw with the episode, because it seems a little bit like it's trying to retrofit the mythology of the X-Files onto Millennium, where it's like, there is a conspiracy. There is very much a very literal, tangible, realistic conspiracy. And like, there are physical objects of the conspiracy. There are photos that are passed that have fingerprints on them. They're real. It's not like a demon whispering in somebody's ear. It's not the voice of, is it Richard Cox whispering in the ear of somebody sitting in a prison cell? No, this is somebody showing up with an envelope of kind of people to select from and kind of goading and manipulating and enabling this sort of level of violence. And it's notable, actually, because I think I mentioned on Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions, I've been reading Chaos, which is the book that Tom O'Neill wrote about the Manson family and the Manson case. And again, I think it's a fascinating read. I don't know how much of it I actually buy into or how much of it I actually believe, but it's a fascinating glimpse at sort of conspiracy subculture. And there is a very strange strand of conspiracy subculture. And I want to be very clear, I'm not endorsing it. I don't think that there's, you know, much to it or anything like that. I don't necessarily believe it. But it's fascinating in terms of, again, stuff that, say, Carter would have been looking at in terms of writing, say, The X-Files. Is this idea of stuff around, you know, mind control, LSD, MKUltra, Counter-Intel-Pro, and that sort of stuff that was happening in California in the 60s? And it's notable that Kempler, who is one of the inspirations for Dion in this episode, was one of several high-profile serial killers to have emerged in California kind of in the late 60s, early 70s, along with Charles Manson being another example. Manson obviously casting a huge shadow over the show, you know, the San Francisco setting of the second episode, the quote that he gives at the start of the episode sort of focusing on Paris, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions. And it's kind of weird that it feels like Millennium is kind of dipping its toe into that very, and it is, even by the standards of fringe conspiracy theories, a very fringe conspiracy theory. But the idea of, like, you know, governments or CIA or kind of, you know, intelligence community sort of meddling in these kind of mind control experiments and using serial killers in California in the 60s and 70s, it feels a little bit too much like something that belongs on The X-Files, if that makes sense. It doesn't feel millenniumistic, you know, in that context to me. But I do find it interesting.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see where they would have gone with it had it been continued on the way that it was going, because there seems to be, now I'm not saying there is, but there seems to be a desire to add that as an extra layer. And, you know, we've gone through, like, as you say, The Judge and the Legion-esque stuff, Lucy Butler stuff, and Alistair Pepper, and all those elements which are more of supernatural ilk, but this is like a very real fear. So I don't know if that's something that Carter would have kind of thought about, because he's one of the things that you've mentioned on several occasions is that his idea of evil and the home and all these type of things, whether or not an actual real threat from a not from a supernatural element, but having this extra layer of this person pulling the strings behind the scenes would have given him another like strand to pull from.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It would have been interesting to see where they would go with that. Now, obviously, you know, we do get the Polaroid Stalker in the next episode, and we won't go into too much detail.
But he's a bit different than how he's conceived here. It would probably be the safest way to say it.
Yeah, exactly. So he's slightly different. But yeah, so he is interesting. And yeah, you're talking about like sort of Ed Kemper and Manson, which is something that, as I say, I think we can briefly talk about that now because we don't need to necessarily talk about Henry too much at this point. But you look at the likes of Mindhunter and now compared to where Millennium is at the moment, well, was then, and the comparisons that's obviously going to draw with the material and the fact that, you know, a lot of the stuff in Mindhunter was written by the person that Millennium's been pulling off. So what did you think of the Ed Kemper sort of framework that they went to build around Henry?
Well, it's kind of it's interesting in terms of, again, this ties back to this idea of empathy and compassion. And again, it's something that Millennium has done quite a bit. And it's something that, again, I feel like it's weird that I'm going back to Hannibal for so much of this. But again, Brian Fuller has been very candid that's influenced by the work of kind of Thomas Harris, and it's drawing from the same sources that would have inspired Millennium. But like one of the things that defines serial killers in the work of, say, Thomas Harris, which was obviously an influence on this, is the idea that what makes serial killers monstrous and evil is that lack of empathy and that lack of understanding that other people are people, and the fact that they treat human bodies in a way that reduces them to kind of utilitarian purpose. So, for example, they see human beings as basically meat or as objects. And again, it's notable that the killers who inspired this, Kempler, who not only like inspired the physical frame of Henry Dion, which we'll talk about later on, because the use of Mike Starr as Dion is amazing, and the use of physical space, and is some wonderful work by Thomas J. Wright in the episode. Mm-hmm. But the cutting of the victim's kind of larynx and vocal cords was a Kempler move as well, I believe. And it was also, I believe, inspired, like Dion, by an overbearing mother and a desire to be heard again and a desire to speak. And even then, I think there's the influence of, is it Henry Nadeau, who murdered several women to use them as mannequins for his photography?
Yeah, yeah.
And the idea that, like, what you do with a person and what Dion does with a person is he reduces them to an object, basically, to somebody to listen to him without talking. Somebody to whom he can speak, but to whom he doesn't have to actually listen. Somebody who doesn't have any concerns or any agency or any perspective, who exists like literally buried in a pile of leaves so that he can go and vent his feelings and feel like he's heard or feel like he's listened to without actually having to do the hard work of like actually engaging with another human being, connecting with another human being, and having empathy that's necessary for any working relationship to happen. And again, this reminds me a lot of stuff like Hannibal, where Hannibal literalizes this, where you have bodies that are turned into, at one stage in the first season, a body's turned into a cello, to give an example, or a body's turned into a beehive, for an example. But even Hannibal Lecter himself, who turns a body into meat, it's nothing but a source of meat for Hannibal Lecter, because he doesn't see that there's a person inside it. And it resonates very well with the theme that runs through the episode that we kind of discuss of empathy and compassion, and the idea that the empathy that Frank has and the empathy that hopefully we have, and even the empathy that the episode kind of has for Dion within obvious like set bounds, is something that is entirely missing from him. And it's telling, like, Mindhunter is really great, and it's coming, like, it'll be out by the time the listeners are listening to this. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's really, really good. It's fascinating as kind of like Millennium Origins, but it's also fascinating in terms of like how you would do a show like Millennium today. I mean, you've alluded to the idea of it being episodic and the difficulty of binging and stuff like that. Mindhunter is absolutely fascinatingly structured in terms of television episodes, where it feels like it shifts the break in the episode. So it feels like the split between episodes is like a commercial break rather than an episode end. It's very, very fascinating. But it delves into this stuff in a way that wouldn't have been possible on television, on network television in the late 90s. And Kempler in particular, and again, it's striking because I didn't necessarily twig this until I saw him. Kempler in Mindhunter is portrayed in a way that is very reminiscent of the way that Dion is portrayed here. This big, hulking kind of figure of a man who is also strangely baby-like, but also completely terrifying.
Yeah, and it's a brilliant portrayal as well. So I would definitely recommend anyone who's not seen Mindhunter to give it a go, because the Kempler character as well, and obviously it's based on a real person, and you know there's a slight amount of adjustment with doing that, but it has real, like, sort of, what's the word? It's the things that he did to the co-eds that he did, and then eventually his mother and the person who actually portrays him. And as you say, the framework that they've gone and looking back in
Millennium. Cameron Britton is the name of the actor, actually, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's I mean, and then you look at actually pictures of Ed Kempler at the time, and, you know, he's done a fantastic portrayal of that, and that's something definitely worth looking at. And as you were saying there, the fact that the what Mindhunter does is... from real life interviews that were taken, and obviously Manson was the big one that he wanted to get, but the interviews last over a number of episodes, and that's something that would have been interesting if Millennium had gone down that route. It certainly would have been good.
It also feels appropriate, actually, that, like, Kempler was one of the first serial killers to consent to giving these interviews, and one of the, like, core bases of this sort of, like, science of forensic pathology. And it's kind of amazing that, like, the Millennium then uses its Kempler analog at the end of the first season to draw the shutters down, but also to say, like, goodbye to all of this, to say goodbye to a certain version of Millennium, which hinges on this kind of very literal, very kind of, you know, direct adaptation of forensic pathology. So it feels appropriate to a certain extent that, like, Kempler was there. And again, I'm wary of, like, reducing Kempler, who did truly monstrous things, to, like, a little anecdote on a podcast. But I do find it interesting that Kempler was there at the beginning of forensic pathology, and the show circles back around to him when it's like, okay, this is kind of our thesis statement on this. We've done a year of this. Next year, we're going to be doing something that is slightly different. So let's wrap it up. And they go back to Kempler. It feels symmetrical to a certain extent. And Ouroboros.
And there's no mistake that the fact that at the end, when Henry actually does say to Frank, now you understand, that's kind of basically, you know, a little nod to say, you know, this is what it was. So we'll get into actually Henry's personal characterizations in relation to Ed Kemper and himself as the character Henry in a few moments' time. But we've got a couple of things I want to discuss just before we get there. First off is, what did you think to the FBI scenes, when Frank was profiling? Basically, Frank was showing off, effectively, in some ways, that he was showing off his profiling skills, that he's being asked about Millennium, is he well paid, is there evil, and the religious aspect of it. It all seems a bit kind of signposted to what the show was, but I don't know what you thought of the actual elements of that and whether or not it worked for you.
Frank made a joke. That was my big takeaway.
Like, he did, yeah. I completely forgot he made the joke.
I remember watching the first season of Millennium, because again, it is very tough and very grueling. And I remember, like, one of the big takeaways of Paper Dove, and again, maybe this speaks to it being an episode that is more, you know, empathic than a lot of the first season, but it's like, Frank said something and it was hilarious. But I mean, even little things like the conversations he has with his wife, where he's talking about, you know, this kind of makes me a little bit excited. And it's like, here in my parents' house. And he's like, do you think they know? Which is, again, a lovely little sort of small scene between the two. I don't think the show has always been as effective at selling the idea of Frank and Catherine as, like, you know, more than a platonic sort of, like, best friends.
Yeah.
But I think Paper Dove does that really well. I'd also like to point out Emily Vanderwerf's comment in the AV Club review, where she observes that even in Chris Carter's shows, even married people aren't safe when they have sex, which is kind of a wonderful observation. But the sequence that you mentioned with the FBI agents is interesting, because it does allude to something that the show has been dancing around but never quite articulated at this point, but which it kind of goes whole hog in, like, literally in the opening scene of the next season, which is this idea that the Millennium Group is not necessarily something that is as simple as a stand-in for the Academy group. It's not just a group of consultants who happen to solve serial killers. They're actually possibly involved in something that is bigger and more ambiguous, and something that is a bit more hazily defined. And the show, again, wary of giving too many spoilers away, but it does, that's an avenue that it really goes down in the second season, kind of commits wholeheartedly in the second season. And I think that's something that's polarizing about it. I adore it, to be absolutely clear. It is odd in the context of the first season because it feels like that hasn't necessarily been fully seeded and developed. It feels strange that they're like, well, this organization with which we regularly consult, yeah, and have been working with all season and have invited into our FBI headquarters and have shared all our resources with, they're a bit strange, aren't they? They're really strange. How about you tell us how strange they are, Frank? It doesn't feel necessarily entirely earned in, you know, watching it at the time, but when you go back in hindsight, it actually works quite well as a springboard into what the show does in the second half, I think.
And the fact that he says on the money that, you know, did you get your paid well? He went, not yet. Which is like, right, okay, he's still on the, which still gives the indication he's on the fringes of the group, and, you know, and what the group would be obviously will change significantly to what they were going to maybe do with the Academy group, and it goes in a completely different way. But yeah, I thought that was a nice little sign. As we get towards the end of the episode, we get introduced to the mother. Now, AV Club mentioned that the mother was kind of Lynchian, which was something that I never even thought about until today. But what did you think of the mother? Without going too much detail into how she affected Henry, but the mother's portrayal and how was that off-putting to you? Did you have that Lynchian feel to it? How did you feel on that side of things?
I'm not sure I'd describe it as purely Lynchian, because I think that, like, again, Lynchian is overused as an adjective when it doesn't apply to anything that is literally done by David Lynch. Like, Lynchian is a very specific adjective that you use. And again, because it's a style that is, you know, often copied and never equaled. But again, it's no, you know, it's no secret that, you know, Lynch was a significant influence on The X-Files, and particularly not because he was a significant influence on television in the 90s in general. And I mean, it's notable in the context of, it's ironic that when I watch the episode and I think of David Lynch, it's not necessarily in the context of the mother, it's in the context of the, she's dead, wrapped in plastic.
I did think that today, actually, looking at it, I was thinking Laura Palmer. Definitely.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. But with regards to the mother, it is definitely heightened, it is definitely surreal, and it is definitely uncomfortable. And it's very effectively done because it kind of tilts the show. And again, this is something that I'm willing to accept that I'm not speaking for every Millennium fan out there when I say this. But when the show tilts towards the absurd and the weird and the surreal, it works for me almost as well as it does when it goes sort of full-blown dark. I would much rather have kind of the surreal, absurd, domestic, low-key, simmering, unsettling, kind of vaguely kind of can't put your finger on why it's wrong, but it's very wrong horror of a mother kind of squeezing the cheeks of her 6-foot-something son, serving him up dinner as he winces and can't get a word in, over kind of the more gratuitous excesses of something like Loin Like a Hunting Flame. I'm sorry I keep kicking that episode in the, you know, here, but you know, you kind of get that. It's off-putting in a way that isn't, that is more effective for me because it feels uncanny and because it feels a lot less like what I expect from a Millennium episode, if that makes sense. It kind of catches me off guard. It's a left hook. It's definitely wrong. It's definitely horrific. But it feels like something that belongs. And again, this is ironic. You know, Lynchian is the adjective that was used there. It kind of feels to me, and again, a very tame version of, network-friendly version of, to be absolutely clear, what it reminded me of is segments of Natural Born Killers, actually, in terms of kind of the heightened kind of domesticity of it and kind of the sense of it being something from the 50s and there being a sense of something very wrong happening underneath a very conventional scene. I'm thinking of the scene with Rodney Dangerfield, in particular, which shot like a sitcom. And this is something like that as well, where you have that shot coming into the house, which is from Henry's perspective. And it's you know, at one stage, it is a serial killer stalking shot, but it's also like a, well, this is kind of actually, this place that is his home is unsettling and uncanny for him. It's like we're in the head of a victim to a certain extent. It's like we're kind of crouching through a house trying to avoid Mike Myers, as opposed to being in the headspace of Mike Myers. That works very, very well for me, and I really like it. And then you have little touches of absurdity, like the fact that she's wearing her dish cleaning gloves. And there's kind of the French accent on top of it adds a layer of uncanny. Later on, you get an explanation from him about why he tried to lose his French accent. That's why he sounds like Mike Starr. But in the context of the moment, it's something that doesn't fit and kind of layers the weirdness on top in a way that is really unsettling. Again, in a way that you can't tell why it's unsettling. It just is, which is the best kind of unsettling for me, at least.
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of that. I mean, as you know, I'm a big Lynch fan as well. Now, this, it didn't feel quite right because I don't know if it's because I wasn't expecting it, whereas in something like a Lynching thing, or, you know, you get to the end of season two, then there's obviously comparisons to be made there where I think, you know, I came to Lynch quite late, so I would have seen Millennium before I saw any of the Lynch stuff anyway, so I would have thought it was a bit off-putting and a bit strange. So Henry's character, with him speaking to the dead, you know, he's wanting them to silent them, is obviously part of what the background is with his mother, and him wanting to be a DJ, and he's also being manipulated by both the Polaroid stalker and Frank, especially with the as we get towards the end of the season, end of the episode, with using the gay and the mentally unwell aspects of it. And he then eventually breaks the circle of the abuse that is endured by killing his mother. And the scene with the, you know, the family, the having the cut hand and the road trip, and all of that aspect of it is bundled into this one character. And I think that overall, that really does work. I mean, what did you think of Henry's character overall, with all those aspects that have been put into him? On top of that, you've got the template of Ed Kempler. How did you feel that went, especially as you were mentioning about the empathy, and especially like the family events, and, you know, having to cut, help with the cut finger and things like that? How did you feel that all went, really?
Well, that's the thing, is that, like, again, he's completely unforgivable. The episode is completely unambiguous about the fact that he is a monster. Again, that shot of him, like, with the sort of apron on, and with the sort of, like, the photo being taken, and the fact that he's bundled up these women and brutally murdered them. Like, it's never ambiguous about sort of, you know, where our sympathies are meant to lie. We're clearly meant to believe that he should be captured, and that he should, you know, he should be arrested, and, you know, hopefully get the proper treatment and sort of, like, attention that he needs, but also be locked away from society so he can't cause any harm. But at the same time, there's an understanding that he is a human being. He's not, like, Satan. He's not a devil. He's not a demon. He's not a monster. He's not an alien. He is recognizable as a person. And again, that's the thing that works so well in that scene with the woman and the little boy, where it starts out as this kind of, it looks like it's going to be this standard serial killer stalking sequence. He's going to come at this woman out of the woods. He's going to grab her. He's going to drag her off. And you expect that, like, maybe the husband or the boy will come and will be like, "Mom, where are you gone?" And then the next shot will be her dead body. But instead it goes a kind of a different direction than you expect it to go. It's the same thing with the house, when he goes home to the house and the mother shows up. And it's something that exists to kind of cast him in a different light, or to at least add a bit of shading or nuance. You know, where he's allowed a motivation, a justification, a background, but he's also allowed more of his own personality and his own life outside of this grotesque thing that he does, which is kind of fascinating, because a lot of Millennium characters at this point, so the serial killers of the week, you know, are largely, they're figures that you see lots of close-up of their eyes darting around. You see their hands in extreme close-up. You get very quick cuts of them. Maybe at the end you get some ranting and some raving. You get talk of biblical prophecy. You get lots of screaming and shouting. You get a, you know, a justification conversation that is cut off when the cuffs are slapped on, or when he's dragged away by the cops. But you don't necessarily get a sense of them being an actual person who sort of functions in society, at least in a passable way. And again, this is one of the things where it is uncomfortable. You alluded to the thing where, you know, obviously the FBI goad him. And I love how transparent the goading is. This is the FBI agents who, you know, Frank, you can see why Frank is a particularly good FBI profiler, because he has a sort of elegance that is sorely missing from Kane, who's like, delivers the speech. He's like, "Vocal patterns indicated the caller was a nervous, timid type. Likely a physical coward. He also used certain turns of phrase current in the DC area gay community as well, which is like, I get that you're trying to needle him, but maybe like sprinkle them a bit more gracefully. Don't just go straight into sort of triggering his kind of homophobic sort of panic. And again, you have this idea of masculinity that runs through the episode as well, because again, this is a man who is victimizing women because of his own sense of inadequacy. And again, you have this sort of tension that exists where he's a nurse, which is, you know, again, and well, you wonder how much of this is the context of this being a 90s TV show, but also much of it is the idea of conventional gender roles that exist and how, you know, sort of men are to a certain extent sort of like trapped by those gender roles, where his mother's like, you know, I thought you had to be a nurse. Why don't you work as a nurse? And you get a sense that he feels emasculated by that to a certain extent. And it's another way in which he's been overwhelmed and sort of dominated by the mother as the kind of haunting figure in his life. But again, it's telling that how he lashes out is he lashes out at women, and how Frank gets at him and how Frank threatens him, or how Frank sort of undermines him and goads him, is by kind of needling him in that idea of masculinity, by presenting him as a coward, or by suggesting that he's, again, and again, this is something that plays, you know, the episode is not at all endorsing kind of homophobia or anything like that, but it's playing with this idea of kind of conventional masculinity as men, particularly, you know, in the 90s and beforehand, would have been accustomed to see it, where it's like, if you are seen as being gay, you're implied to be effeminate, and therefore that attacks this traditional idea of masculinity as it's existed. You know, that sort of argument. And the way in which the episode sort of gets at that, it's not subtle, but it kind of works. And it's, again, I think the episode understands, and again, this is something that Millennium as a whole, I think, understands in a way that doesn't always get credit for, which is this idea of masculine violence. And this idea that, you know, the bulk of kind of serial killers, the bulk of violence, you know, is men inflicted on women and stuff like that. And I think the show kind of gets at that, and I think that Dion gets in that as well. He's this idea rooted in a very almost outdated sense of masculinity, and a kind of a complex that kind of stems from that, because he doesn't conform to this idea of what a man should be, in inverted commas, you know, because he's a nurse, or he's henpecked by his mother, you know, or he's, you know, maybe not as successful with women as he wants to be, or as his mother seems to want him or expect him to be. And that sort of way. And so he acts out by trying to silence women so that he can get his own voice heard. And he believes that his voice being heard is more important than, like, you know, the women in his life breathing, which is grotesque and monstrous and unsettling and horrific. I do like, though, and this is something that's interesting in terms of plotting. We're probably going to talk about the cliffhanger in a moment, and I have issues with the cliffhanger, as I kind of alluded to earlier, but I really, really like the resolution of the Dion plotline, because it consists of, like, as soon as Frank figures out what's going on, he literally catches him with a phone trace, pretty much. Like, it's as simple as, we got a trace back to a residence, and we figured out where he is, and we're going to arrest him. And I kind of love that, in a sense of, like, again, this is what we're talking about with Millennium moving away from, like, the how, the procedural aspect of catching, the forensic kind of pathology, the CSI style of storytelling, which is like, well, the hard part is actually catching a killer. And Millennium's argument is actually, no, the hard part isn't catching a killer. The hard part is understanding a killer. Once you understand something like this, or once you wrap your head around it, that's the uncomfortable part. That's the part that's monstrous. That's the part that's hard to do. Once you do that, actually catching them or ensnaring them is quite, you know, it's not, I don't want to say simple or easy, but it flows organically from that, which I really liked, because it kind of subverts the idea of, well, Frank is going to get into, like, a complex battle of wits with Dion. You know, they're going to be playing, it's going to be like, you know, Dirty Harry with the Zodiac, you know, sorry, with the, you know, Scorpio, apologies, with Scorpio from Dirty Harry, and they're going to be trading back and forth and bantering over the phone. And it's like, no, Frank pretty much figures out what's going on quite quickly, manages to ensnare Dion, and Dion sort of falls into that trap. And again, it feels like, again, the sense of closing the book on this chapter of the show, because it's like, well, Dion is one of the most complex and interesting serial killers of the week that we've had, but he's still at this stage something that Frank deals with pretty quickly once he figures out what's going on. So, you know, maybe it's time for the show to move a little bit beyond this template. I will say Mike Starr is great, by the way, as well. And shout out to Thomas Wright directing this, for the way that he frames him. And it's actually fascinating, because once, after this episode, the show goes into widescreen, particularly on the DVDs and home release. I think it was broadcast in standard 4x3 for its entire run, but it was shot on widescreen for series 2 and series 3. So you have this boxing effect with Mike Starr, who is absolutely huge, again modeled on Kempler and Ed Kempler, is that you have this effect when you put him in a shot with anybody, and it's particularly noticeable in the way that it's shot with the scenes with the women's bodies, where Mike Starr is so large, and again he's great in the role, but his physicality is amazing as well. It automatically seems like he's smothering them in terms of the way it's shot. He looks almost like a block. And even when you have him in shot with other actors, he makes them look small. And the way the camera's positioned, and Wright uses a lot of low angles for this, in order to give you this effect of making him seem tall and imposing, and like he's kind of suffocating the frame. So you get a real sense of scale that really works. And again, you know, we don't talk about television direction as much as we should, but television direction, particularly in the 90s, was kind of coming a long way. And this is really, really, really good stuff from Wright. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I pick up on a few things that I've done in podcasts in the past where, you know, there's not as a particular direction. People like Rob Bowman, who is amazing, and obviously Kim Manners, who does a lot on The X-Files, which have fantastic direction style. Yeah, I mean, you're right at the closest. And obviously, you know, when you get into film projection and things, that you've got a wider canvas to film in. You've got different lenses you can use, and you know, the scope can be a lot bigger, whereas, you know, when you're doing TV, it's a lot different, and you know, time constraints and actual, you know, you having the use of equipment is a big thing as well. So to be able to get that on a TV budget is really good, and you have to make use of it. And I think Thomas Wright, over the course of the time that he spends in Millennium, I think does a fantastic job. I think he must do over at least, well, it must be close to half of the direction, I would have thought. He does quite a lot.
He does at least a third. I think it's like 29 out of 72. So yeah, he's does a significant portion. And again, he's a standout artist in that regard. And it's a shame that Millennium isn't better known, because his work is really, really good. I would group him along with those great directors you mentioned, the X-Files, Goodwin, Bowman, Manners, Nutter, and sort of like, I think that, and again, Millennium doesn't necessarily have the same stable of directors that The X-Files has. It doesn't have those sort of like four or five names that you can point to and say those are really great directors. Nutter, I think, directed The Pilot and Gehenna, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, did you?
But like outside of that, it's Wright is pretty much carries the bulk of the show in terms of direction. And that's not to denigrate the work of other directors who did great work, but it's Wright who largely defines what I think of when I see Millennium in my mind's eye.
An episode I always go back to when thinking about this episode is something that has been seeded is the Wild and the Innocent, with the idea that the framing device in there was that the girl was talking to Frank in the prison cell, and we're being told things through letters and through her being interviewed by Frank. In this one, we're being told Henry's story through the act of the dead women being talked to, and because they've been kept silent because the mother is so overtly talkative and you know,
domineering
and abusive in that way. What did you think of that element to one, progressing his arc as well, but also what we get to the end as well with the whole killing of his mother and the MacGuffin that we do see, the knife just before he actually decides to use it. We actually see it put on the table as well. Yeah. So what did you think of the way that it's framed and the way it's given Henry a bit deeper character?
Well, it does, because first of all, you're right in pointing out that the exposition scenes are largely about him delivering his backstory and getting a sense that, because again, like the way that Millennium is typically structured is that Frank shows up and Frank tells you about the pathology of the serial killer of the week. And, you know, I mean, here they're talking about like bedwetters and animal torturers and stuff like that. And all that stuff is important in terms of psychologically profiling a serial killer. And all of this is important in terms of like catching them. But it does, you know, it can be a bit reductive and dehumanizing. And, you know, I mean, that's entirely fair, because your point is to catch a serial killer. That's your objective there. You know, you're not out there to kind of make friends or paint them as people. But in terms of telling a story, having that device of having, you know, Dion talk to these women allows him to put his own life in words. And again, this is the thing where the episode is entirely clear about how monstrous he is. It isn't like, oh, poor Dion, except, you know, but it does acknowledge that he has suffered and he has his own perspective. And it's notable that, again, what he's doing is he's repeating the trauma that was inflicted on him, which is that, you know, he can't get a word in edgeways with his mother. And again, something that Wright does that's very good is the shooting of kind of the way in which the scenes with Dion and his mother are shot, where she kind of domineers him despite being physically smaller and less imposing. You know, when she's hugging him, when she's holding him, when she's squeezing him, you know, he looks almost like a giant baby in the shot to a certain extent, and she's very much in charge. She's the one who's kind of driving it. And you have this juxtaposition of this idea of what he's learned from her, what he's internalized from her, is this idea that in order to be heard, the idea of what a relationship is you talking and the other person just sitting there being silent and not able to get a word in edgeways, and kind of treating that as a platonic ideal, and therefore kind of repeating the cycle of violence upon itself, which is, again, not to it doesn't excuse anything that he does. It's very clear that he is, you know, a monster and horrible, and, you know, he's not somebody that we should feel a great deal of, like, sympathy with. But it's also somebody for whom we should recognize as being a person. There's a great line from, I think, Red Dragon, the Thomas Harris novel, where Will Graham is confronted with what the serial killer has done. And he talks about, like, his backstory and his pathology, and he reads through the booklet and the account and the diary and all this material that, you know, Dolarhyde has put together. And one of the characters notes that Will almost seems sympathetic to the killer that he's catching. Mm. And his response to that is, like, as a child, my heart goes out to him. As an adult, he's irredeemable. And there's kind of that juxtaposition between the two. And I think that applies to Dion as well, where you understand why he ended up the way that he did. But you also, at the same time, understand that what he has ended up with, ended up as, is grotesque and unsettling. And the episode does that well. And again, that's the juxtaposition. It's him telling his backstory, talking out loud about his experiences, trying to lose his accent, trying to fit in his dreams of being a DJ, which is all very sympathetic and very humanizing, while talking to a woman who he's killed, who's wrapped in plastic, yeah. Which underscores the horror of what he's become. And I think the episode does that very, very well, that balance.
Yeah, and as I say, with the wild and innocent as well, the fact that he does break that cycle, but it's where the wild and innocent breaks a cycle in a particular way, this is the only way that he's managed to do it is to kill his own mother. And then, as we say, at the very end, when he says, you know, now you understand, Frank. What did you think of that conversation between the two of them? It's very downplayed. It's an interesting conversation. Well, you know, line that he says to Frank. What did you make of that?
Yeah, it's very much eschews sort of what you would expect from the series finale of the show about serial killer of the week, where the stakes are going to be higher than they've ever been before. Where it's like he really doesn't have that much of an interaction with Frank Black. He's aware of Frank's existence because the Polaroid Stalker has told him about it. And, you know, even when he's on the phone talking to Kane, he alludes to knowing who Frank Black, is. But, like, in the context of that confrontation itself, it's very low key, it's very underplayed, and it's very much, again, it feels like the show is to a certain extent, and I know that there are people who will disagree with this, and I don't think I'm being overly dismissive and unfair, and I accept that entirely. I think the show does some interesting things with serial killers in its third season, even in its second season, with Mikado, and stuff like that as well. But in the context of this episode, it feels like the show is kind of saying, we've said just about everything that we really want to or need to say about this sort of serial killer. Now you understand. You've reached the end. This is where we are. This is who we are to a certain extent. Yeah. But this is like, we've accomplished empathy. Empathy has been achieved, and we can move on to maybe doing something else next year, which feels like a kind of a fitting kind of end. I know this probably wasn't what was planned. I imagine Carter wanted to do things in the second season that would build on this. But in the context of the show that we got, in the context of the show that as it exists today as a season, as a three season object, like, it feels that sequence of Dion saying, now you understand, to Frank, while looking at the camera and also kind of saying it to the audience as well, feels like a fitting culmination of the kind of season that we've had to this point. And the idea of doing a serial killer of the week, where it's like, actually, you know, I do feel like I understand as much as I am going to understand with this template of story to this point. I think we've done it. You know, mission accomplished.
Catherine gets the call, but then there's a hang up. Now, whether or not that was just purely for reaction, where it's throwing you off balance, thinking that Catherine's going to be in danger, because there was that element that could be happening. Because earlier in that scene, earlier in the episode, there was a scene where Henry is with the Polaroid Stalker, and they see Catherine's photo, and he turns around to to Henry. Henry turns on to the Polaroid stock and says, "It's not for me." Effectively, what did you think was the real thing behind that? And then moving forward, which I think is the main point for it, is that the Polaroid stock is effectively asking Henry, if, you know, or giving Henry the idea of potentially pushing him to go down the route of abducting Catherine. But that doesn't happen, and he has to put things into his own hands and actually does it himself. Is that how you viewed it, or did you see it differently? And then finally, what did you make of the final moments of this episode?
Yeah, I think that's kind of vaguely how I kind of read that interaction between the Polaroid stalker and Dion as well, because there's that sense in terms of, aren't you going to thank me? Their first interaction, where it's implied that, like, and again, like, the Polaroid stalker is walking around with these photos of women. And it's almost, it's like choosing out of a catalogue. And again, it goes back to stuff like Gehenna, where you have this kind of juxtaposition of kind of high stakes, you know, high scale sort of capitalism, where you have this idea of this cult that is also selling things. It's a telemarketing scam where you're selling ideas and visions and dreams. And so you have these billboards and stuff like that. And you have this idea, you know, you have the Polaroid stalker here taking a really kind of morbid perspective and viewpoint on it, where he's wandering around to serial killers and offering them pictures of women and saying, which of these do you want? Which of these victims do you want? These lives that I've reduced down to a kind of a two-dimensional snapshot, which of them, you know, is the one that, like, picking something out of a calendar. And again, it's not out of a calendar, sorry, out of a catalogue. But yeah, it's that sort of like juxtaposition between the two. And it kind of, yeah, it again, this is the thing where I'm not sure whether it's too much going in that it's like, oh, by the way, and serial killers are now unionized. Which, you know, there's the, they'll work for someone, I think, is Dion's line. And the Polaroid stalker returns with, you know, well, there's always someone, you know, as if to say, I will go out and I will find another, you know, killer at Serial Killers R Us. And he'll do it. Don't worry. He'll be fine. And that, yeah, again, this is the thing where if you look at the mythology of the first couple of seasons of The X-Files, where you have lots of ideas that don't pan out either, things like aliens abducting animals to create Noah's Ark in fearful symmetry and stuff like that, that don't necessarily pay off in a meaningful way in terms of the larger arc of the show. Because again, the writers are just throwing ideas out there, seeing what works and like trying to find ones that they can latch onto and ones that will, they can kind of fit together in a Duplo way. So it's entirely possible that this would have been a narrative dead end. Even if Carter had stuck around, he would have said, actually, the angel stuff worked better than this. Yeah. Or he would have said, actually, this works better than the angel stuff. So let's keep focusing on this. And it's kind of hard to predict that, or hard to kind of imagine where that would have gone based on what we have at the moment. I do think that there are, I think this arguably seeds the, and again, not to jump ahead for listeners who haven't seen the show already, I think that you can draw a clear line between this episode and the final episode or final two-parter of the show, even beyond the connection that exists with the Polaroid stalker between the two episodes.
Yeah,
but I think
see that
thematically, yeah, you can indeed. and I would, in terms of the actual ending, and this is the bit that kind of, you know, this is the bit where it kind of docks the marks for me. This is what holds it back from being one of probably the best episodes of the season. I still think it's one of the better episodes of the season, but what holds it back from being one of the very, very, very best episodes of the season is the sense of kind of the cliche of it all, where it's like, we've wrapped up the case of the week, but oh my god, Catherine's been kidnapped. And Catherine being kidnapped feels like the easiest possible end of season cliffhanger that you could do on a show like this. It's like, well, the hero has a wife. Let's victimize the wife so that, you know, we can have some emotional leverage going into the second season. So we have this idea of stakes. And again, the show hasn't, and again, I'm cognizant of, first of all, the fact, you know, the wonderful stuff that Megan Geller has done as Catherine. I also am, you know, cognizant of the fact the show has occasionally found interesting angles into Catherine as a character in episodes like The Well-Worn Lock, to pick an example, but even things like Blood Relatives. But generally speaking, the show hasn't always realized Catherine as effectively as it might have, and hasn't completely sold her as a character exists outside of Frank's immediate orbit. And so it feels, to me at least, a little cynical that the first season cliffhanger that kind of comes roughly out of nowhere. Now, it's seeded throughout the episode. It's very clear the Polaroid stalker's interested in her. But again, the episode's largely focused on Dion. The Dion plot is resolved. They're going home. And it's like, oh, bam, she's been kidnapped. And it's like, fine, okay, that's what we're doing now. That's the hook into next season. It's not like the Erlenmeyer flask on the X-Files first season, where there's a clear sense of escalation, and then the X-Files are closed and Deep Throat's dead.
Yeah.
This feels like a sharp left swerve, because it's like, well, we need to bring viewers back for something next season. And it's like, fine, kidnap the wife.
Yeah.
And it feels very cold and very calculated, particularly in a season that is so predicated, you know, an episode that's so predicated on the idea of empathy, but also an episode that is so cognizant of this idea of reducing women to physical objects, of reducing women to, like, material or to things that exist in order to gratify men. You know, it understands that reducing these women to, you know, dolls that will listen to Dion talk about his dreams of becoming a DJ is something monstrous and grotesque. But again, and this provides a nice sort of bit of symmetry with what I talked about at the start of the episode with the Polaroid snap, where the real question is, are we the Polaroid stalker? Are we looking at the pictures? Mm. But the show's use of Catherine feels, you know, doesn't feel 100 miles away from that sort of crass exploitation of kind of female characters or of women, where the show is like, hey, we can use Catherine to provide emotional leverage on Frank. Because the final shot of the episode is Frank crushing the paper dove with his hand. The final shot of the episode is not Catherine's in danger. The final shot of the episode is, boy, Frank is really mad now. Which yeah. just feels very crass. And again, I don't want to be too harsh, and I don't want to be too cynical about it, but it does jar a little bit. Now, I think the second season does some really, really great stuff with this. But like, as a cliffhanger of itself, without considering the second part of the episode, it feels calculated in a way that is jarring to me as a viewer, even now.
That's the end of the episode and the end of the season. We've had a fantastic run. You've been on quite a few of them, Darren, and it's been a pleasure to be on with you. There's a lot to be expected from next season. We've got Adam Chamberlain's coming back for the beginning and the end. So for the beginning of season two, which will be on, we're continuing straight through. We're not having a gap or anything like that at all. So hopefully we'll be on time for The Curse of Frank Black on Halloween. So that'll be fantastic. And the Midnight of the Century, I think, is going to be aimed for Christmas as well. So we've got a lot to do, Darren. You're back. You'll be back.
Hopefully.
Yeah, we've got Chris Knowles. He's coming back as well. James McLean, who was a big part of the Back to Frank Black podcast.
Amazing. And, I'm actually really looking forward to that.
Yeah, so he's coming in for an episode, and he may well be on a special one that we're going to do. We're looking at maybe doing a couple of extra episodes that are not episode-based, that are more generic.
Thematic,
more thematic. Nice. So we're looking at some more of that. And Tony will be doing a few, which has been nice. Woo! You know, he's been a bit of a miss over the course of the season. I think he only did one or two, so he'll be coming back. So that's quite a lot to look forward to in season two. We may well have an interview as well, or maybe possibly two. So that'll be all be coming for season two. So just before we go, we've got the mailbag, and just any final thoughts that you've got on the episode. Have you got any final thoughts on the episode before we go jump into the mailbag and then sign off?
No, I think we've actually pretty much talked through a lot of it, probably to death. I apologise to listeners, but it's been fun. I really enjoyed this.
Well, what we'll do then is we'll jump into the mailbag. Okay, so Adam Silver, he says, a decent episode, but besides the cliffhanger ending, not really worthy of a season finale, which is basically what we've just been saying, which should have had the return of Lucy Butler or something else more interesting. What do you think to that then? The fact that Lucy Butler, the Judge Legion element, you mentioned it in the main bulk of the episode there, that there's none of that at all in this episode. Do you think that that's something that should have been done, or do you think it would have... And do you think it would have been more of a pull to get into next season? How do you feel that that would have gone?
Well, this is one of the things where, again, hindsight is kind of 20/20. I can't imagine watching it the first time. I wonder if I watched it the first time, where is the demon stuff? Where is the angels? Where is the war in heaven? Where is this abstract battle between good and evil that's playing out? Why am I dealing with, like, the dude who plays mobsters all the time? What's he doing playing a serial killer? I thought we got past that. I don't know in hindsight, I don't know looking back if that's how I saw it the first time I saw it. But with hindsight, I actually don't mind it too much. Because again, we talked on the show before where, and again, this is something where I probably deviate a great deal from a lot of kind of Millennium fans, is I'm not necessarily sold on the idea of a Legion mythology. I quite like the fact that it's so disconnected and alien, and it doesn't fit the sort of template that you expect from the X-Files with its kind of conspiracy that handily explains everything. So I don't mind this. I really like that this feels more like a thematic season finale, where it's like, we've reached the end of the serial killer of the week, so let's do one last serial killer of the week, and it's going to be one of the better ones, in my opinion. And it feels like that's a fitting note for a season finale. I do think, as we discussed on the episode, like, from beginning to end, the cliffhanger feels obligated to a certain extent. It feels like an obligation rather than something that happens organically. And that does jar with me in terms of it as a season finale.
Yeah. So the other message that we've got is from Jordan David Evans, which actually is quite interesting, because he says, love this episode. A good end of season episode leaves on a good cliffhanger when Catherine is being kidnapped. So that's someone who's from the opposite side of what Adam's been saying, that it should have finished on something like Lucy, where John David Evans actually comes across as someone who actually enjoyed that element to it. So as you mentioned before earlier in the episode, everyone loves their things for different reasons, and that's what makes the show so good, that you can come at it from various different viewpoints. So that was all from the mailbag. So finally, Darren, any final notes on season one? Anything you want to say about the season as a whole, just before we wrap up?
I think, and I've kind of gone on record about this before, but I would argue that for a season and a half, Millennium was one of the very, very best things on television. And again, not to jump ahead and spoil my thoughts on the second season. The second season is one of my favorite 20-odd episode seasons of television ever produced. I know it's divisive, and I know the fans have different opinions on it, but for me personally, it kind of hits the sweet spot of everything that I want from a 22-episode season of television. The first season is by necessity a bit of a kind of a mess. It's a bit of a curate's egg, because with any first season, you're figuring out how to do what you want to do on a weekly basis. You're figuring out what the show's about, but also how you're going to reproduce that 22 times in a year. It's a tough thing to do. And we've done The X-Files. The X-Files has a similarly kind of tough first season where it tries to figure out what it's trying to do. I would argue the first season of Millennium is much stronger than the first season of The X-Files, perhaps because Carter and some of the writers that he's worked with as well, and a couple of the directors as well, have the experience of coming from The X-Files. So to a certain extent, it feels like it's branching off from The X-Files rather than starting from scratch. I think that the first season of Millennium has some of the best stuff that Carter's ever done. Carter himself has singled out the pilot as one of the episodes of television that he is most proud to work on. I would agree with that. I think the first half suffers a bit, and it's reductive, but this is a very brief summary from the Serial Killer of the Week format, where it gets a bit repetitive, a bit overly familiar, and a bit wearying, where it falls back into familiar patterns. But I think that once you hit Force Majeure, which is a masterpiece, to be absolutely clear, the season becomes a lot more inventive, a lot more playful, a lot more creative. And you start seeing things like, what can we do with this format? So you have episodes like Walkabout, you have episodes like Covenant, you have episodes like Lamentation, which are all of which completely different from anything that I had seen on television to that point. And when you're watching a TV show that is not only showing you, or me, I'm not going to generalize, maybe people have broader experience than I have, but when I was watching television that was showing me something that I had never seen before on an almost weekly basis and doing it remarkably well, that is something truly special and truly spectacular. The second half of the first season is genuinely amazing, with the possible exception of Broken World. And the fact that I can only single out one episode as a possible exception speaks to how good that second half is. I absolutely love it. If I were rating the first season out of 10, I'd probably give it an 8, because the first half holds it down. But if I were rating the second half from Force Majeure on, that's a straight 10. Yeah, I adore it. I think it's amazing.
Where can people find you online, Darren?
So Darren_Mooney at Twitter. I write a blog at The Movie Blog with a 0 rather than an O in the word movie, where I post sort of regularly. I also host a podcast called The 250, where we take a look at the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time, one at a time. When this is coming out, I think we'll be reaching the end of our sort of summer of 1999 season, although it seems to have extended far, far beyond summer. But we're taking a look at some of the IMDb's like best movies of 1999, so things including Fight Club, The Legend of 1900, American Beauty, The Green Mile, stuff like that. We've got a host of great guests, so I really hope that you might join us if you find that interesting at all.
Yeah, it's something that I haven't listened to yet. I haven't got round to it yet, but I think you did you've done the Matrix and things like that as well. Definitely 1999. I was 19 years old, so it was a perfect, perfect year for me. It's a perfect good year in film. So it's certainly something that I'll be looking forward to. For me, you can find me on my Twitter feed, which is at R Muldrake. That's R M U L D R A K E. Okay, so we will catch you in season 2. But until next time, everyone, this is Who We Are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.